The poet Gioia Timpanelli has been doing something different lately. She's been writing prose novels. But her novels can't escape poetic sensibilities. They're almost epic poems. Timpanelli's latest is no exception. It's a novel called What Makes a Child Lucky. It's a story of hunger set in rural Sicily about a boy named Joseph. Joseph experiences the brutal killing of his best friend. And after being tricked by his brothers, Joseph ends up being kidnapped by the murderers. But Joseph finds mercy and kindness in Immaculata, the old woman who cooks for the murderers. Gioia Timpanelli told Anne Strangechamps about the novel and about the differences between being a poet and a novelist.
Well, it's interesting. I call myself secretly a poet. In other words, even my poetry is prose poem. Nature itself, as a child, was my poetry. Oh, there was this great pine tree outside the house in Northwest Connecticut where my family went. And I used to go to this old tree, a huge pine, and I was in awe of it. I just loved it. And I used to make stories up around it. I used to look at it. I cared about it a great deal. And this was another part of my life. And I'd say that poetry was also part of that, that there was something in that. I used to write songs to my cats and my big black cat, my grandmother's cat, really, but mine too. I was just a little kid. And that inspired me tremendously, all beings, like creatures. And I don't know, but poetry was associated as well with that.
So it sounds like you're suggesting that no matter what you write with a deep kind of poetic sensibility, whether it comes out in the actual form of a novel or a short story or a poem.
I think that's probably true. I never thought of it in exactly that way, but I know that that's true.
Well, the writing in this particular book is so lyrical. I wanted to ask you to read just a passage to give us a taste from the very beginning. What makes a child lucky?
Okay, let me see. Sicily. At the end of the 19th century, or any place at any time. Hunger, she said, is very personal. At first, it even tricks you into feeling guilty over your own misery, guilty for your human lack of grace. It holds your wrists tightly in its bony fingers. It breathes its foul breath into your gaping mouth as you sleep. But wait, we said. Doesn't this happen in a story Ovid tells about Erisichthon's hunger? What does it have to do with now? It's an old story. True, true, she said. But why do you insist on being literal to time? You see, time might change the details, but the story of greed and retribution, or as you moderns insist, of cause and effect, is essentially the same. Erisichthon starves in his soul as well as his stomach. Why do you believe hunger could never happen to you, not where you are, and not now among your people? You think you're too well off for hunger to find you? Ah, my friends, we thought exactly the same.
Oh, that's such a chilling beginning to the book. And, you know, until I read it, it had not really occurred to me how many old fairy tales and folk tales have hunger at their core. I mean, think about it. Hansel and Gretel, Jack and the Beanstalk, the old Sicilian story you're working with for this book.
I think the ancestors gave us stories also about a time when people were indeed hungry. As they are all over the world now, right now, to this day, children and people hungry. And our ancestors gave us stories about times that were lean. And we have a full spectrum of human experience in these old stories, these humble old stories, so that you find when there's something at the beginning that's missing, the story in its rich, generous way will come back and give us something that feeds us, that feeds the real child, that continues to make the story at the end find what was missing or lost at the beginning.
Mm, I love that story as a kind of food.
Mm-hmm. Yes, that is true, too. That's true.
You know, this is a story set in Italy, set in Sicily, so of course food is central, as it is in Italian culture. But it's not just food. It's the way food and landscape are kind of woven together. So there's a passage. Yes. I wanted to ask you to read where your hero, this young boy, has gone off to the wilderness, and he's living there with a bunch of bandits under the supervision of the one woman in this group, this kind of mysterious woman. And there's a little lull in the action, a kind of lyrical morning, when the boy goes out to gather some wild asparagus on the mountainside. I wondered if you could read that section.
Oh, yes. I spent hours searching for wild asparagus up in the mountain meadows, climbing higher and higher. The beautiful Sicilian spring day made me feel drunk. In the middle of the highest field, I picked a few stalks, and just as I was adding the last to my collection, I heard the scattered tinkling of sheep bells. And then from someplace, I heard a whistling sound, a shepherd's pipe. I followed the music until I saw the shepherd playing his pipe, sitting on an outcropping below, his back to me. I walked out of sight and lay on the blessed ground, and for the longest time I listened to the music. I can't tell you how long I stayed there, for time was lost, and when suddenly the music stopped, I heard a great rush of that tling, tling, tlinging of tiny sheep bells, and I finally stood up to see below the shepherd and his flock, a vast crowd now moving quickly down the mountain.
Oh, that's gorgeous. And funny that that passage you just read kind of connects really strongly to the last section I just wanted to ask you about, just because I think it's so lovely. There's a moment when Immaculata looks, the boy is going away, and he asks her to bless him. And she does, but all she does is looks at him. Could you read the passage where he describes that look?
Okay, let's see. Okay. When I got a few feet away, I turned to wave, but instead I surprised myself and called out, "Bless me, Immaculata." She looked indifferently at me for a long minute, as though she were composing herself. Then her entire face changed, and without hesitation, she looked right into my eyes with the most compassionate look I have ever seen in my life. No one had ever looked at me like that before. It was powerful, and it lasted a long time, or that's how it felt. When that look of great feeling, of a large caring, went through me, I felt a kind of well-being surrounding me. Before this moment, I had only understood that word compassion in terms of deeds and actions. Deeds and actions I understood, but a look that could change you? Another strange thing was that this intense look did not exactly come from Immaculata. As soon as I felt it, I knew that someone or something that was extraordinary had put eyes to a vast source, maybe some great heart, and had looked at me. Whatever it was, I now knew that there could be such a thing. She gave me that blessing before she turned, and without another word disappeared into the farmhouse. That was the last time I saw Immaculata.
I love that passage. I don't entirely know why I love that passage so much. I think it's something about the boy's sense of something so much greater and larger coming through this woman's eyes. And maybe this is really reaching, but I wonder whether that's part of what you were talking about in terms of how a poet feels about the language. You know, that there's so much embedded in every single word and coming through the words you use.
Yes. You know, oh, that's really so. I write in images, right? I see the story. But then I hear it. I always pass it through my ear. There's no other way I could write anything without my ear being the real arbiter.
Poet Gioia Timpanelli's novel is called What Makes a Child Lucky? Anne Strangechamp spoke with her.